Marshall and Sagar here. Welcome back to The Realignment.
You have a billion Indians and a billion Chinese and a ton of other people who are smart, who are just held back by terrible systems, right? They're held back by socialism, held back by communism. Now they're competing on the world stage. But one of the consequences of this is that the West, especially the US, is souring on free speech and free markets because, you know, I tweeted this, but basically, I think a deep point, the East Coast establishment no longer wins a game of truly free speech and free markets.
Our guest today barely requires any introduction, Balaji Srinivasan, angel investor, former venture capitalist at Andreessen Horowitz, CTO of cryptocurrency platform Coinbase, Stanford PhD. Balaji is unique in that he is one of the many persons on Twitter who has a lot of thoughts and is very prolific, but at the same time is able to back up those thoughts with serious critical work that helps people understand the way the world is going to go. We start the episode by referencing this, but Balaji is unique in that back in January 2020, he had a really excellent tweet which said, COVID is coming. Here's what's going to happen. We're going to see increased nationalism, border closures, hoarding, face masks. Basically, every single thing he predicted came about. And as you all know, the theme of this show is we want to look at where the world is now, where it's going to be tomorrow, and help you all think about it. So us doing a forward-looking episode that didn't dwell as much on coronavirus and then looked at the world in 2025 was the perfect place to go.
Yeah, and Balaji's new thing, which I think is absolutely fascinating, is about how India can actually be a new emerging power center, which rivals actually the US and China, not through traditional means, but actually by embracing cryptography, Bitcoin, and more. It's certainly a unique worldview, but it's one that we wanted to explore here just because Balaji's been right about so many different things. You'll remember the prophecy during our Eric Thornburg episode that the most frightening words in the English language are Balaji was right, so we were here to explore a little bit of that. Okay, so you guys know the drill. Make sure you subscribe to therealignment.substack.com. If you want to ask us a question, you can reply to the email that we send you after you sign up, or you can comment on any of the newsletters that you hit your inbox every Friday. That's where we've got links to our bookshop where you can purchase books that we recommend or those by the guests who frequently appear here on this show. And with all of that, let's get to the question and answer period.
Today's question comes from Kevin, and Kevin asked this question to us by email. Now, I know some of you prefer email, so definitely send us an email at realignmentpod@gmail.com if that's where you'd like to have your questions come in. Hi, guys. I really enjoy The Realignment and Rising. You guys often mention deficit hawkery in a negative tense, and while I agree that deficit concerns should take a backseat during a global pandemic, there has to be some level of fiscal responsibility from the government. I think it's fair to say that more often than not, the government, on every level, is about as responsible as a college kid with an Amex. What do you think?
So, Marshall, I'm going to sub in here, friend of the show, Joe Weisenthal, because I actually did an Instagram Q&A, and somebody asked me this exact question, and I got him to give me the perfect response. Quote, "Because when you're borrowing in your own currency, you can never run out of money. The only risk is inflation, and that's a function of too much demand for goods relative to supply. The deficit doesn't have any bearing on that question." That's about as succinct and perfect of an answer as I can get whenever it comes to what's wrong with deficit hawks. Now, look, Joe's probably a little bit full-blown MMT. So we're probably, what, somewhere in the middle of Marshall? And is there a limit in order how much you can borrow before there's a huge problem? Yeah, maybe. There's actually Noah Smith just wrote a really good piece about this, but we are nowhere near that currently. And so I think that the answer to your question is yes, there is a limit, but right now, especially in times like this, I much more tend to side with Joe than anyone else. What do you think, man?
What I love about this question is because it's a Balaji Srinivasan episode, there is going to be a lot of cryptocurrency, Federal Reserve, inflation is coming, people. So these new entrants to the show are going to be very ticked off at us coming into it. But no, I want to make the point. A, I'm happy that he recognized part of our critique is about the politics of deficit spending. So our broader point, and we've never argued that the debt literally does not matter. We have never argued that we should literally never care about how much money is being spent. Our point has just been that during a global pandemic, something which is the equivalent from a lives perspective of the number of Americans who are dying during World War II, now is not the time to have mostly bad faith statements about our grandchildren needing to not deal with a national debt. Because much of these same people, during a much different era in our politics, 2017, were perfectly fine supporting tax cuts that in many ways were not paid for. So that is the broader critique we're making. I'm more than interested, and we actually want to book an episode that goes into the case for deficit hawkery, but I frankly only want to have that conversation with an economist or a public policy person who's making that case outside of bad faith politics, because that's what we're really pushing back against, and I appreciate you for recognizing the difference between the two.
100%. And to all the Bitcoin bros, if you can send me evidence of real inflation in the marketplace, I will send you 0.00001% Bitcoin. Okay, so with all of that, thank you to the Lincoln Network for sponsoring this podcast. We really appreciate all the work that they let us do. Let's dive in, guys.
Balaji Srinivasan, welcome back to The Realignment.
Great to be here.
Good to see you, Balaji.
So let's start with the victory lap for you, especially for folks who are coming into your new world. A year ago, you had a really great tweet, which we will put on the screen for the folks on YouTube. Around January 25th, I believe, so we're nearing the end, we're a little past the anniversary, where you were talking about there's this new thing called coronavirus. It's going to change the world in these different ways. So I just want to start with us going through, A, why you made the calls you made, how those calls held up, and then finally, where you think those calls are moving going forward. Because as you know, the whole point of our show is the world is shifting, institutions don't work, and the people who should be listening to this are people who are looking to find their footing in those sort of moments.
Yeah. So about a year ago, I was tweeting about Corona in January and February of 2020. And it's funny, you know, like one of my friends has a thing, which is like, the worst thing in the world is when Balaji is right, you know, and mainly because there's a lot of out of the money predictions, I think, that I make that are about negative things that could happen, but that could be mitigated or avoided with strong action today, right? So essentially, like, possible significant downsides or possible significant upsides if you act today on something that seems implausible. And with this particular thing, you know, like I wouldn't call it a victory lap because, you know, unfortunately, the outcome has been bad for society, which is that, you know, this prediction I made a year ago was that the coronavirus would lead to, if it became pandemic, would lead to border closures, nationalism, social isolation, preppers, remote work, face masks, and distrust in governments. I think all of those have happened, just going through
literally them, all of them.
Literally all of them, right? And you know, some, you know, like basically were happening contemporaneously, like the border closures. But one of the things I sensed was that the world was sort of in a bistable state where it could be pushed over or maybe rewound back in some ways. And this pushed it over, you know? And so we're very much in the next era. Like, we're not going back to the Obama era, the era of let's call it US-driven internationalism, a US-managed, quote, rules-based international order. That's not coming back. I do think what we get is not just nationalism, but also crypto internationalism, which we'll come to in the next part. So we're not going to completely go away from international trade and finance, but it's going to look quite different. It's going to be managed by code rather than by the US government. Okay, but coming to these points just briefly. So border closures, basically, we've got lots of countries around the world that have imposed either two-week quarantines or bans or significant restrictions, travel bubbles and whatnot. The world is just dramatically less open than it was in, you know, 2019. And this is a huge amount of sand in the gears in some ways of globalization. Now, we will see what happens with vaccine adoption. We will see what happens with new variants. there's a possibility that digital nomadism takes over from tourism, which is to say, rather than lots of short trips, which may involve quarantines, you can't just do a 1 week vacation when there's a 2 week quarantine. The upfront right. cost is too much, right? So rather than lots of short trips, what I do think we're going to see is cities and states pivoting towards recruiting people for permanent or semi-permanent international or domestic migration. And so the border closures are not completely closed necessarily, but they're closed except to economic migrants who are going to stay there a year or 2 years or 5 years and actually build something for your local jurisdiction. So you go from the short-term arrangement of tourism to the longer-term arrangement of, like economic migration. And that's related to kind of point B, which is nationalism. Again, you don't have a global world anymore. You have countries that start to be not exactly every man for themselves, but certainly more so than they used to be. One example is Germany was buying vaccines, or reported to have bought vaccines outside the EU framework.
Right.
Right. That's huge because Germany is, in theory, the co-CEO of the EU, along with France. They're thought of as the engines. And so even the co-CEO is kind of operating outside. This is similar to the US, under Trump, and probably which will continue under Biden, the CEO of the international order feeling that the international order no longer works for it, which it doesn't certainly for every American. You can certainly argue that, Trump's constituency doesn't work for every American. But basically, the CEO set up the whole thing and then is working outside the thing that they set up. That's like this weird thing. The same thing happened just now with Germany, right? And this deglobalization and renationalization, one of the things about it also is that it was happening in a way that cut across, political axes, because, a pandemic is absolutely undeniable. You're not talking about, do we want immigrants or do we not want immigrants, and are immigrants good people or not? People can agree the virus is bad. And so that's like kind of an apolitical fact where you probably don't want to bring the virus into your country. And so that's like broadly agreed upon. And so it just gives a different gloss on things, That's why I said it's going to shift 10 to 20%. Okay, point number C.
I just want to add something real quick, which is helpful, which is, and this is why speaking about these trends right at the start of the Biden administration is so important, because one of the first things the Biden administration did was they furthered border lockdowns, especially to South Africa and other countries. So there was a world where, and this is why I love your point about there's no going back to the Obama era, where the Biden folks could have said all this nationalism, border closing, it's racist, it's nationalist, it's Trumpist, we're going to put that all away. They didn't do that. And this is also why I do not think there's going to be a border crisis on the scale of Obama in 2014, because even your most progressive, open borders person has to understand that you can't just have that happening during coronavirus. So you'll see crackdowns and serious security in a way you wouldn't have seen from a progressive administration in the past.
Yes. So, I think actually one way of thinking about it is and this is not meant to be provocative, but simply, and I'll see if I can justify it at least on some axes, just like Obama was in some ways actually Bush light, Biden will in some ways be Trump light.
Yes.
Right. And so not the second Obama term, but the second Trump term in some ways. There's a guy actually who I see eye to eye with. His name is Jose Alvarez. And he's a professor who has written about international law in a Biden administration and gave, an address. And I'm just going to quote this at length. I'll paste the link in as well. But, expectations for a full reset after the 2020 election need to be lowered. The coming international law restoration, while real, will be tempered. Trump's single term cemented the following characteristics within U.S. foreign policy. Number one, a pronounced preference for alternative normative instruments in lieu of multilateral treaties. Number two, a more wary, hostile approach towards China. Number three, deep skepticism of the world trading system. Number four, reliance on punishing bad actors through trade sanctions. Number five, circumspection towards UN system organizations. Number six, avoidance of most international courts and tribunals. Number seven, aversion to, quote, never-ending wars and resistance to humanitarian use of force, RIP for R2P. And number eight, ever more, quote, ironclad commitments to Israel's security. Now, I agree with most of that. I'm not sure where the Biden administration is going to end up on Israel, for example. There's certainly—
Quick thing, Senate just voted 97-3 to maintain Jerusalem as the capital of Israel, which was a policy, which, so that's the perfect example of it.
Wonderful. Okay. So then actually, yeah, I hadn't seen that. So then actually he seems to be 8 for 8. That's the only one which I was questionable about because, you know, mm-hmm. the squad and others want to do like BDS or something like that. Right. So
that's not going to happen under him.
Yeah. Yeah. So that was the one which I was kind of, you know, question mark on, but basically, you know, I don't know if you remember, there was this Onion article on Diamond Joe Biden. You know, like where he was kind of in front of the Corvette and
yeah,
and
yeah. So Uncle on, right? Joe. Yeah, yeah, yeah. Uncle Joe. Right.
Yeah, yeah.
That's where the meme comes from. Right.
Yeah. You know, that's actually, of course, it's a caricature, but that's actually not that far away from Trump, you know, and mm-hmm. this is not meant to be like dissing anybody or anything like that. But there's, you know, it's something where, you know, like certainly he's not as combative or, you know, he's not going to like trash people on Twitter in the same way and so on. In many ways, like personally, you know, he'll behave, you know, in much more like dignified fashion. I think that's all that is true. But in terms of where this is coming from, I think these 8 points are correct, where you are seeing America kind of becoming less a global platform and more of just a country, you know, and retreating from like maintaining an international order, which means being the global cop and you know global free trade and so on and mm-hmm. so forth. And so the reason I bring that up is I as you mentioned with the immigration stuff, I don't think it's going to be a complete reversal. We'll see what happens. We'll mm-hmm. see. I think there's some things obviously where the executive orders have immediately reversed stuff, right? But the general direction, especially in terms of foreign policy, in many ways, the wokes are actually as unilateral as the MAGAs. Like one way of thinking mm-hmm. about that is with this digital deplatforming of all of these people, you know, not just Trump, but also the Amazon ban of Parler, they weren't thinking as much about the overseas impact. And, you know, suddenly you had France and Germany and Mexico and India and all these other countries basically saying, wait a second, if you can deplatform, you know, the president of the US, you can deplatform anybody, right? I mean, like, yes, of course, you know, there's reasons for it. I'm not actually, you know, I don't want to litigate all the reasons and so on. Okay. If you think there's an actual, you know, possibility of violence or whatever, I understand all that. However, the deployment of this digital nuke against quote other Americans is such a reversal from like, you know, 7 years ago when, you know, tech companies talked about net neutrality, or they went to Obama and they said, hey, we're against NSA surveillance because that harms our business overseas. Seven years ago, like tech companies understood that the appearance of neutrality was extremely important for them to be global platforms, right? They understood that was actually, you know, there's an enlightened self-interest aspect of resisting short-term calls for things that seem reasonable in the short term, because they would compromise the long-term stability and adoption of the platforms, right? You can Google this actually, you know, the NSA 2013, you know, Obama, you know, business meeting, like with the tech executives, like, mm-hmm. Here's one. Tech executives to Obama, NSA spying revelations are threatening business, right? Because, you know, that like at the time, they were still relatively new. They're still growing, you know. Now what's happened is that, you know, for a variety of reasons, people have gotten so fat and happy or have lost sight of their values or whatever, that they've just kind of taken for granted that all these countries around the world are just going to have to use them, or they just weren't even thinking about it at all. So either it was arrogant or it was ignorant, but it was unilateral, right? It was very much unilateral. Yes. And that is a, you know, is it quite as unilateral as, let's say, you know, Pompeo, you know, or how the State Department was under? No, it's not as explicit as that, right? In the same way that, you know, like Obama's, you know, like various military operations in the Middle East, it wasn't as explicit as the Iraq War. You know, it was framed under R2P. It was framed under drone strikes. It was framed under civil liberties for, you know, during the Arab Spring. But there mm-hmm. was quite a lot of war that was waged there, right? You know, even if the optics were somewhat better, you know, there's this kind of meme, which is like, you know, the bombs are coming out of an American plane. And the second mm-hmm. one is bombs are coming out of an American plane with like the LGBT flag on it, right?
Yes.
And so like bombs, but woke, right?
Or they're like, at least they're female pilots or something.
Exactly. That's right. And so the thing about that is it does have slightly better optics. That's true. But the substance is felt overseas. And you know, this is also related to something where, you know, under Obama, there was a degree still of, you know, what I'd call intellectual curiosity about, you know, like other countries, right? Mm-hmm. And part of this is, you know, the flattening aspect of the internet where, you know, you're talking to foreigners who are Americanized in many ways, right? And the mm-hmm. export of culture. Part of this is the idea that, you know, it's considered taboo to point out any differences between American cultures and other cultures. You're basically, unless it's something as silly as, oh, Europeans are just better than Americans in every way. And, you know, like that, that's a level of granularity. You cannot have any kind of conversation about, you know, oh, this might be better than that and we can learn from them, or, hey, we're doing this better, they might be able to learn from us. The give and take is simply not possible because it's considered to be, you know, bad or taboo, which is I think silly. And so because of that, you know, after a certain point, once you repeat the slogans enough, it really does melt people's brains, right? So the discourse has become so dumb, and it's become so focused on the US and so focused domestically that the eye went off the ball of the rest of the world over the last 5 years. You know, like essentially, go ahead. A digital
a quick question, because I love everything you're saying and I buy the analysis, but I had a question because you were tweeting about Angela Merkel and the digital nationalism, especially with the Twitter deplatforming decision. I completely understand it. We're going to get into this when we're talking about India. I understand the idea that a country needs to have its secure financial system. I understand the idea that, especially when it comes to applications, surveillance, this goes into the TikTok debate and the Indian App Store decisions, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. I get the ideas for how a country could be nationalistic in that sense and why there'd be a good case for that. I don't understand how that works in the social media sphere. For example, Angela Merkel should totally want there to be a German financial system that American companies can't decide to do. I think the lesson from the AWS decision is that countries should probably have their own server and hosting capacity, especially in controversial spaces. But German citizens want access to Twitter. So it wouldn't make sense to say, hey, we've launched this German-only version, which is really German-facing. If you're the Iranian regime, I understand completely why you don't want to have America dictating social media decisions, but the Iranian people don't want this. And Sagar, we were talking before, give your Saudi Arabian example, because that's very helpful too.
Yeah, it's fascinating, because I was thinking through your framework too, Balaji. I mean, Saudi Arabia, one of the most, you know, authoritarian, you know, monarchies in the world, they actually have 80% of their population onboarded onto Twitter, like something like 80%. Twitter is actually the entire political square within Saudi Arabia. And actually, some of it supports many of your theses about pseudonymity and about political activity. But what the Saudi Arabian regime has done is, instead of banning Twitter and being like, oh, no, they recognize its power with its population, and they just hired a bunch of people to game Twitter's algorithm and in order to mass swarm people who are dissidents. And so in that case, I think MBS, I mean, if MBS is a person who literally has someone murdered in a consulate, butchered, like, I don't think he would be above banning Twitter. He's like, no. I understand the power of this platform. I'm just going to use the power of the state to, in many ways, like, game the platform itself to try and maintain control over my citizens. Like, I don't know if he's as threatened by the deplatforming Trump, the decision as you're kind of putting it that way. I'm just curious why you think that he hasn't reacted in that way.
I think there's a short, medium, and long term. So I agree with what you're saying. Basically, I think nation states will, you know, treat Twitter and more generally social media as a forum for war, right? You know, B, right? So it is you know, just like there's air and there's, you know, sea and there's land, right. It is cyber, a theater, right, of combat. Exactly. You know, that's right. It really is. And it's not what people used to think it was, which is power grids and the water and so on. Social media is a theater of war, right? So yes, nations will do that. And they will also regulate it like Poland did and so on, you know, passing bills. So they'll send in their guys, regulate it and so on. B, of course, by the way, the U.S. does this abroad too, you know, so it is something where it's only, oh my God, I can't believe they're doing it to the U.S. Well, the U.S. is absolutely, you know, the Arab Spring had a lot of Americans posting, you know. And it's fine, whatever, you know, just one shouldn't be so outraged when turnabout is fair play, right? So nations will treat social media as a theater of operations for politics and war. B, they will build their own, you know, like China's already done, like India is on the verge of doing. Every large enough either state or cultural group of states, like the Visegrads, you know, or, you know, probably Russia with Belarus and you know, the Soviet bloc, probably Japan, you know, could do its own, right? That kind of thing, right? Every state will then build its own, so call them national platforms. Mm-hmm. And this is made easier, by the way, in 2021, because there's so much open source stuff that's happened. There's so much cloud stuff that's happened that, you know, the front ends and the back ends of many of these platforms have actually stabilized. You know, this is something I realized a while ago. It's a non-obvious point, but a very important point from just a technological standpoint. You know, think about YouTube's UX or Twitter's UX, Uber's UX. It's basically been stable for years. I'm not saying there aren't some changes or edits, you know, like Twitter's adding like the, you know, stuff, but it's different from the early days of a technology where the UX changes every few months and there's massive improvements that are made, like Google going to instant search. And so those are actually pretty big changes in the earlier years. What that means is when you've got a stable front end and a stable back end for many years, it means that open source catches up. Right. And so it becomes cheaper and easier to do it. Like, I don't know if you saw, but like, you know, Clubhouse, for example, has one full-time iOS engineer, right? Mm-hmm. And that's because Agora is like this really good API and you can use it for real-time audio. So the leverage of individual engineers has increased. So what would have been kind of comical, I remember, you know, 10 or 15 years ago, France tried to do like the French Google, and that just wasn't possible then, right?
Yeah.
But today with like Common Crawl, it's much easier. Like it's the level of difficulty has dropped. I'm not saying it's easy, but it's easier.
If you have will, point, like if you have the will, it's actually feasible.
Yeah, if you have the will and if you have the skill, right? And so with all these tech unicorns around the world, it is becoming, you know, easier to clone these American services, especially the ones which are more execution oriented, like email or chat or social networks. There's certainly a difficulty in scaling them up to 3 billion people, don't get me wrong. But doing the 30 million person version is much, 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 much easier than it was 10 years ago. A lot of that stuff has become commoditized. And in terms of distribution, so that's on the technology side. On the distribution side, a nation state, a sovereign app can just mandate that everybody adopts it, right? So all tech people think in terms of persuasion, but all state people think in terms of coercion, you know, because, you know, money persuades, but power compels. And so, you know, once you can just clone the app, if you can just mandate that everybody in your country be on it, you've got 10 million users in a day, right? Or whatever, you know, a week or month. We saw this with the COVID apps, you know, like the contact tracing apps and so on. You start to see these sovereign apps just totally go vertical in terms of adoption because the government can tell you to do it, right? Mm-hmm. And that's just something that is sort of neither tech people nor state people really think about it quite that way, because it's an interesting hybrid of where the product is coming from tech, but the distribution is coming from the state, right?
Yeah.
Okay. So coming back to this point, then the third thing is crypto. Because so A, governments will go and treat social media as a theater of war, put in their bots, you know, like or people or whatever. B, they'll build their own national apps. But C, and this is very important, I mean, all communication and transaction is not going to be domestic to domestic, right? Indians are not just going to communicate or transact with Indians, Saudi Arabians, right? There's a huge amount of international transaction communication, right? Whether it's domestic to international or international to domestic, those are somewhat different, but they're going to exist. And in that case, you can't just have the nationalist apps. You can't just have, you know, Saudi Twitter and Indian Twitter and Chinese Twitter. You're going to have some neutral platform. Mm-hmm. And what folks I don't think have realized yet is that neutral platform is actually not going to be the dollar or the renminbi, because neither the legacy incumbent nor the up and comer are fully trusted by other countries. I think it's going to be crypto based platforms. Where,
Balaji, real quick, because we have a diversified audience here. So when you're referring to like renminbi, the dollar, you mean like the US legacy system and the rising China system. So could you just explicate that a tiny bit?
Totally. So the dollar is not simply a currency, it's a technology platform, right? So there, you know, there's things like SWIFT, there's ACH, there are, you know, international wires, domestic wires, there's all of these countries that have either fully dollarized, like they've pegged their national currencies to dollar, mm-hmm. or they hold dollars, or they buy
trade
oil.
In dollars.
Exactly.
Yeah.
That's right. Yeah. So, you know, between countries, you know, like Brazil wants to buy oil from Saudi Arabia. What do they both value? They might do that deal with the dollar. They'll probably do that deal using the dollar, right? I believe that the petrodollar regime sort of mandates that Saudi Arabia is supposed to use the dollar for buying oil. I'm not sure if that's still true, but I remember it was or was reported to be a while ago. So the dollar is a technology platform. And in fact, it is America's most important export today, I would argue, right? In the sense that America can coin it at will, right? So both it is a digital currency of a proto-digital currency of a sort, where it's basically the most valuable product America makes. And in many ways, you can argue that the trillions of dollars that are being printed, the US is, I had this kind of half joke, half truth. The US is now a welfare state in an unusual sense, where all the dollar holders and users around the world are subsidizing the US's printing of tons of dollars. Mm-hmm. Okay.
This is what the MMT people say too. Like they unironically say that to a certain degree.
Well, because what you're getting at is the reserve element of the currency. And it's like, well, whenever you have other people here, you're subsidizing it through your power of being able to print and support the domestic economy.
That's exactly right. And this, by the way, is another example of how sort of, I think, the Biden era folks are also in their own way, highly unilateral, because when you're printing that much money, well, you are diluting down. Let's say you print all that money and then you distribute it to Americans. Okay. Now, MMT people would say, oh, we're going to distribute to everybody equally. In practice, it seems to be going, to the richest people to buy equities, right? So whether you think it's going to the richest Americans or you think it's going to all Americans or whatever, it's going to Americans, and it is not going to all the other people who are using the dollar around the world who, are either losing access to SWIFT because of, this or that sanction, or they are, by the way, the US has a lot of sanctions that it's imposed on the world, something like 7,900 active sanctions or something like that. Last I looked, it's like, this is something else that this Jose Alvarez mentioned. I'll quote his point number 4. Yeah. He said, reliance on punishing bad actors through trade sanctions. And of course, this catches lots of innocent people. If you go and look at, the specially designated nationals list, which is basically all the folks you're supposed to ban from any payments app. There's a lot of people who are named this will sound stereotypical. I don't mean it to be. There's people who are named Muhammad, have a Muslim name of some kind, who are caught up on that list just because they have the same name as some guy, right? There were Somalians who were unable to send funds abroad, in Minnesota several years ago, totally innocent people, simply because, oh, the Horn of Africa, well, that's terrorist. And so we're sanctioning it, right? So there's enormous collateral damage that is done by the US's control of the system. And they just wield it like a totally blunt instrument like this. Oh, you're a terrorist, you're a bad guy, you're this, you're that, right? So that's how to think about the dollar. It's not simply a greenback. It is a technology platform. And, Alex Rampell, my colleague, or I should say, he's not my current colleague, but my colleague in VC and friend and what have you, he has a good thread on this in terms of the geopolitical risk that payments, provides, right? And he's been talking about this for years, even before the current thing. He has seen it as a payments entrepreneur, the extent to which these quote neutral platforms are just increasingly being used as effectively weapons, right? And so, let me just quote this, right? Basically, I had previously written about this repayment networks when I was at Visa. We stopped payment processing in Crimea per US law. Again, right or wrong, friend or foe, it is too much geopolitical risk for countries to allow their financial networks or communication networks to be domiciled elsewhere, right? Mm-hmm. Okay, so that's on the dollar side. Now, what about the renminbi side? So China's an up-and-comer. They're the obvious alternative, number two. And they execute crazy. This is the thing, whenever I talk about this, there's a lot of Americans who, certainly last year at least, maybe still today, I don't know, who have this sort of reflexive thing of, oh, everything that comes out of China is fake, or, oh, you must hate America if you say that, China is doing something good, or, oh, they can only execute on this because they're a totalitarian dictatorship and, they're evil and we could do it too if we're just had slave labor or something. And I'm not saying that some of those points don't have some force to them, right? But a lot of them are cope, you know, because, you know, for example, Taiwan was able to get COVID under control and it's not, you know, a dictatorship. And, you know, a lot of Asia has been able to do much better from a technology standpoint. And it's also, you know, not there. What's the point? Point is, China has been executing extraordinarily well. And, you know, if you think about the percentage of Congress people who could define to you what a firewall is or what a blockchain is versus the percentage of Chinese government officials who could do the same. I mean, it's going to be 10x, you know, like it's like probably less than 1% on the first side and probably at least 20 or 30% on the other side, maybe more. You know, Beijing is launching this blockchain-based government where they're trying to put everything on chain. So meaning incorporations, they've got a really detailed document on this. Every traffic certificate, stock certificate, or rather traffic ticket, stock certificate, every you know, official like board resolution you do as a company, all of that stuff goes on chain so that you've got a programmable financial and legal system where some of the enforcement is delegated to smart contracts, right?
And so what's funny though is that it's not the blockchain in the way that our users might think in a crypto in a decentralized context. They're not doing this like out of the goodwill of their hearts. They're doing it to, like, actually they're doing it for the opposite of intention, for a fully searchable and like centralized database, which is on its citizens and on its corporations.
That's exactly right. So they're taking half of it. They're taking a lot of the concepts of general ledger and cryptographic validation and programmable APIs and so on and so forth, and they're removing the decentralized bit. And you know, most people are, you know, will say something to me like, "Well, oh, then that means it's just a database." I'm like, "Okay, but do you know how hard it, first of all, it's not just a database, and here's why. First, do you know how hard it is to upgrade the database like within just one company? Okay. For example, Amazon ripped out Oracle and upgraded to, I think, Postgres or something, right? That was like a multi-year project. And that was like Amazon, one of the most competent companies in the world that does databases.
Well, they are
Exactly. Right. Yeah. Wait, just wait. That's the next project, right? Yeah. So like it took Amazon years to do this. It's a highly technical project. Like the database, it's like your core thing. So even with motivation and skill and money and so on, it's hard, right? Now you imagine doing that for like dozens or hundreds of companies that are all reading and writing to the same database, right? Like, you know, a lot of like DTC, which is the back end of the like trading system for stocks going back and forth, other assets going back and forth on Wall Street. You've got dozens, hundreds, thousands of entities that are reading and writing to DTC. And that's even harder to coordinate all of them upgrading their back end at the same time. And now add on top of it, regulations that basically require DTC and make it illegal to think about innovating. And you've got this enormous collective action problem where just upgrade the database, it's not that easy to do. You know, Rampell, again, my friend, you know, mentioned that, like, you know, they went from so-called T+5 settlement, meaning 5 days to settle transactions, to T+3 in 2004. And then 2017, they got down to T+2. So at this rate, you know, it'll be like 2030 when you're at T+1 or whatever, right? Point is upgrading, go ahead.
Well, no, just two quick things here because we're trying to, I love how quick you go, but we're trying to catch people up. But one, so firstly, on your point about how the Chinese government is effectively like using blockchain or at least planning to use blockchain technology within their system, this is a dynamic that, and I agree, like as you know, if you're Signal, like I'm very much more hawkish towards China than a lot of folks, but you are totally correct that there is a little too much cope with it. It's all cheap. It's all a knockoff. That's a narrative that isn't, right. I'd say at that point, that rhetoric is probably 15 years out of date. But then it also speaks to, and this is where the underestimation comes in. A lot of folks were in the 2000s, well, China, look at the internet. The internet's going to force China to open up or change their dynamics. Right. It's this inherently libertarian, decentralized model. What the Chinese government was able to do is not only use the internet for its own purposes, but at the same time, actually develop new companies, technologies that are now actually a huge soft power win for them, which you're seeing through TikTok and those other debates. So that's an important addendum. But the second part, and I want to get your perspective on this because I haven't made up my mind yet. How much of US governmental failure is the fact that if we walk down to Capitol Hill, Sagar and I are in DC right now, and surveyed congressmen and women, they mostly probably couldn't define blockchains or firewalls, right? That is definitely true. I'm skeptical of how much of America's problems directly relate from that fact. I think that it could be a little too technocratic to look at the specific, largely unimportant backbench individuals in comparison to the broader structure. Because then what I'm curious about is, what is your opinion of the rising rising U.S. leadership class. So, for example, you're seeing folks like Mayor Suarez in Miami, who's posting the Bitcoin white paper on, you know, on the City of Miami website. He is leaning forward into this tech stuff, because what I think is probably going to happen is the folks who can't define blockchains, who can't approach firewalls the way, right? Those are legacy players. And what you're going to see is an opportunity for new folks to come in and enter the stage and be rewarded for that. So what's your just general commentary on the nature of the U.S. leadership class and whether Francis Suarez is an example of something new or he's an aberration?
So Suarez is absolutely an example of something new and very important, which can help reform the U.S. from within. And let me give kind of a macro framework on this, right? And there's like a ton of stuff I can say on this. But first, there's like three kinds of votes, right? You can vote with your ballot, your wallet, or your feet, and call those respectively election, migration, transaction, right? And, you know, all three of those are used, for example, in U.S., you know, the political context, where obviously there's elections, there is migration, because there's federalism, you can move between states and so on, move to Puerto Rico, move to Hawaii, whatever, right? And then there's transaction, people can make political donations, that's legal, you know, you can donate to PACs, you can donate to your candidates, etc. And you can sort of think of this as, there's several things that can be said. First is, when you vote with your ballot, the cost is quite low. It's just going 2 hours to the polling station or filling in a mail order thing, but your impact is quite low also. You have a one out of N chance of being the tie-breaking vote, right? When you vote with your wallet, the cost is higher. You know, let's say you max out at 2,300 or whatever the threshold is. I believe it's 2,300. The impact is harder to measure, but there's people who have done something like the number of dollars spent per vote or something like that, right? Mm-hmm. And so roughly speaking, you know, to very crude approximation, when you spend $2,300, you're effectively getting more than one vote. You know, you're quote buying votes by donating to a candidate, whether Democrat or Republican. You may argue that that is a bad thing, but there's some argument that it's there. If it's a 100-to-1 ratio of dollars to votes, then you're buying 23 votes when you donate $2,300, right? Okay, so you have a somewhat higher impact than 1/N, you've now gone up to 23/N or something like that, right? Okay. And then the third is migration, when you're actually spending more than probably 2,300, it might be 10,000 or tens of thousands of dollars to move, right? But now you have a very high percentage chance of changing the law under which you live, because you have selected that jurisdiction based on its legal characteristics in part, right? Mm-hmm. For example, it has more liberal marijuana laws, or it is, you know, friendlier to the LGBT community, or it you know, has better regulations on crypto, or some combination of those things, right? And so these three forces are all considered legitimate, right? Like that, say all three of them operate in our current context. And what is happening is technology is changing the balance of power of these forces. And what I argue is that you're going to see this century have, you know, election is still important, right? Vote with ballot is still important, but vote with wallet and especially feet will become even more important, right?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And, you know, one way to think about this, again, from like a legitimacy standpoint, is, you know, America is not just a nation of immigrants. Tautologically, every immigrant's an emigrant. So America is a nation of emigrants with an E, right? And the most American thing in the world is to leave your home in search of a better life, right? So right now, we have leaders, political leaders in the West, who are selected for legitimacy, but not for competence, okay? So one way of thinking about that, and I'll give another framework here, which I think of as founding versus inheriting, okay? Mm-hmm. Why is Zuckerberg the CEO of Facebook? Because he founded it. Why is, you know, like a political leader, you know, the governor or the mayor or the president of a region? Because they won an election, right? Founding and inheriting are the two major ways. You might say, okay, I understand founding. Why would you say winning an election is inheriting? Well, in an important sense, a lot of the East Coast is about inherited institutions. In the most basic sense, that's inherited wealth. You're inheriting, you know, some, you know, large family fortune, like, you know, the Rockefellers or what have you, DuPonts, etc. I'm not attacking them, I'm just saying that that does exist. There's old money on the East Coast, right? But in a somewhat, you might also inherit a newspaper, right? Like, you know, the Grahams or the Murdochs, yeah, or Sulzbergers inherit a newspaper, right? That's a more important thing. That's not just money. That is a serious form of power that's being inherited. But maybe the least obvious but most important thing is when people win an election, they are inheriting a organization that they could not have built from scratch, right? So, you know, George Washington assembled basically the US military from scratch, right? And, you know, there was a New York mayor who, you know, basically put together the NYPD. Or there are guys like Robert Moses who, you know, for his many faults, just built a ton of transportation infrastructure, right? Managed to corral all the resources to do that. You might say he did bad things, but he was certainly able to like impose his will and build things from scratch, right? But, you know, when you're talking about like the, you know, 59th mayor or 72nd governor or whatever it is, right? That is like, you know, imagine somebody inheriting a factory and then passing it down again and again and again for like 10 generations. You start to not have selection for competence. You just have selection for legitimacy, which is, oh yeah, they're a legitimate owner because it's the, you know, father, son, son's daughter's son or whatever, right? When you only select for legitimacy rather than competence, you want both, by the way, but when you only select for legitimacy rather than competence, when there's some unexpected thing that hits, you know, you've got this factory that is making hats, and now market conditions have changed and men don't wear hats anymore because, you know, like Kennedy didn't wear a hat. Well, you better change that thing to making something else, or else it's going to go out of business. And so one of the issues is things, inherited institutions that are set up by really great founders can seem to work for a long time until market conditions, political conditions, social conditions change, at which point they're still executing the old script, right? They're dead actors rather than live actors. They cannot adapt. Yeah. And it's in that scenario where that 10th generation, you know, factory scion has to make a change, and they're incapable of it because all they did was cash the checks and, you know, engage in the formal ceremony around factory ownership. It's like cargo cult, you know, like ownership. They've only been selected for legitimacy, but not for competence. They cannot operate the factory, right? Now, extend this to, you know, our political institutions, right? You have folks who have inherited, you know, like the, you know, let's say New York, right? New York City, and couldn't have organized the NYPD or the New York Department of Public Health or anything from scratch. They were just selected for legitimacy for winning an election. And because they couldn't have organized it from scratch, they can't task it with doing something new in the face of COVID. Right? So COVID hits, this completely new thing, and no one can do anything other than shout slogans, right? Because they haven't built things from scratch, and you need to build something from scratch to deal with something new because the old things won't work for something new, right? That's like fundamentally what it is. Like, it's like, you know, skipping leg day. You're not going to be able to do squats, right? Like, you know, and so this is a very important way of thinking about why competency has been lost. And, you know, by contrast, you know, taking this example, you might say, well, Balaji, look, that's a really high bar. You want someone who's able to like organize the US military to be like the president or a leader, someone who could do that from scratch. That's a really high bar. That seems kind of unrealistic. That's a once in a, you know, blue moon kind of person. I'd say, well, Jeff Bezos, Mark Zuckerberg, they're actually on that level. Most people don't understand this, but like, you know, for example, you talk to any general, there's this famous saying, amateurs talk tactics, professionals talk logistics.
Yes.
What is the best logistics organization in the world? Probably Amazon.com.
It's Amazon.
Right.
Yeah.
And built from literally a desk, right? Built from, you know, so he did it with persuasion, not compulsion, right? He couldn't order anybody beyond those people who had opted in to organizing in that hierarchy, right? Zuckerberg built something from a dorm room to 3 billion people, you know? And I mean, that is skill. That's really impressive skill. And here's the thing, that is selecting for competence, not simply legitimacy. You know, Zuck and Bezos are legitimate because they were the founders. Anybody who disputes their authority, well, this guy built it from scratch. Yeah, that's why he's a founder. You know, that's why he's a CEO. He built it, right? But they're also selected for competence. And one way of thinking about this is you can think of political support in terms of backlinks, right? Do you know the concept of backlinks?
Yeah, we do. Yeah, right. Let's explain it for the audience.
Yeah,
let's explain it for the audience.
We totally get it. Go on.
Yeah, so it's just a useful, it's like a completely obvious concept, but it's a useful visual to just explain outside of technology, right? So you take a website like you know, Google, which is a search engine, right? And it's it ranks sites in part by the other sites that link to it. Okay. So if you know, harvard.edu links to your website, well, that's actually valuable. If 1,000 people link to your website, that's also valuable. And they kind of take both the quality of the links that are coming in as well as their quantity, and they turn that into kind of a ranking of sites, right? And in this fashion, when you think about politics, right? Politics is also a ranking of leaders, right? number one, number two, the number one guy won the election. Number two guy maybe didn't win the presidential election, but won a gubernatorial race and so on. It's like a status ranking, similar to websites. Okay. And what impacts that ranking is the quantity and quality of support. Quantity is just sheer votes, for example. The quality is the endorsements, right? Which, you know, newspapers or governors or senators, whatever, are endorsing you, right? And this actually is also operative within companies. You know, basically, as CEO, you don't necessarily have completely unambiguous support from everybody. There's some executives who are kind of grumbling about this initiative, others who are really aligned with it, and they also have their own power bases and whatnot, right? There's a funny kind of thing on this, which I think it's called like the Dictator's Handbook or something. There's also like a video like, gosh, what is it like? So You Want to Be a Dictator or something like that. And it's funny, Rules for Rulers. Okay. Mm-hmm. And it's funny because it's, you know, it's somewhat tongue in cheek, of course, right? But essentially makes a point that people think that a general or a CEO or a president just has like robots underneath them. They don't. They have human beings who have significant degree of latitude in their decision-making. And so you can think of those as backlinks, right? And each one of those has their own set of followers underneath them. And you have to basically give them things. It's a reciprocal relationship to maintain that. All right, what's my point? The point is that when you win an election, you know, one day you're just a citizen and the next day, all the backlinks flow into you at once, right? One day you're just a citizen and then kaboom, you're just like, you just go vertical in terms of backlinks. You know, now sometimes maybe you're like a senator first and then you become president like Obama. So you had some backlinks, but it's very discontinuous. It's like extremely sharp, you know, like day before you have no legitimacy, day after I've got the nuclear codes.
Yeah,
kaboom,
you can nuke people,
right? You can nuke people. That's right. So it's like, whoosh, like this. Whereas with founding, the accumulation of backlinks is rapid, but it's continuous. Like how many users does Facebook have? Well, it's one and then it's 3 billion and it's growing fast, but it's never like, it's not like the step function where there's one day there's a huge election or whatever, right? So it's a continuous process. And one of the aspects of that that's important is that means there's selection for competence at every stage. You know, so it is something where you have to prove yourself to get the next 10x and prove yourself again. Mm-hmm. You can see this very explicitly with like VC financing rounds. That's why there's the C, the A, the B, et cetera. There's a stair step kind of thing. And you might argue, well, that also exists to some extent in politics because you're dog catcher and then you're, you know, mayor and governor. I'm not saying that it's completely distinct. Okay. But I am saying that this is a new way of thinking about it where, you know, founding versus inheriting, how do you accumulate the backlinks? How do you build your base of support over time? All right, let me bring it back to your point. You asked, is the fundamental root issue that they don't know what a firewall or a blockchain is? I'd say that is correlated with, but not exactly the same. The fundamental issue is they have not been selected for competence. And the only thing
you could teach someone what you could like literally say, hey, this is a blockchain, but the problem would still continue the next day, obviously.
Yeah. So that's right. So basically the issue is that they did not need to acquire these skills to get to where they are.
One thing I just want to link this to, Balaji, just to make sure people understand, is what you're talking about is in relation to a broader, like, what is coming. We talked about before the U.S. dollar and the renminbi. For various reasons, neither in your worldview is likely to dominate the international financial system, largely because of geopolitics. America has its own limitations. China, obviously, is not exactly like, you know, they're not doing these things out of the goodness of their hearts.
Right.
And what you're linking to and what you're talking and laying the foundation for is kind of a cryptographic international world order. I mean, in a way, it's its own rules-based order. It's just not American rules-based order. So can you go into that? How does the concept of the backlinks building and with the geopolitics, the replacement level infrastructure that you're talking about, just lay that out for the audience? Because I think this is really interesting.
Yeah. So I mean, I believe in Western values. I don't believe the US is the champion of Western values anymore. But I do think that we will build a new order that is basically, I think of the internet is to the USA what the Americas were to the UK. Okay. So the Americas were this new world that eventually gave rise to entities that succeeded the United Kingdom, you know? And the internet is this new world where, you know, just like, you know, there's like 60 million, you know, Brits, right? There's 300 something million Americans. There's like 3 billion plus internet users, right? So this new world is bigger than the old world. It is, quote, more diverse than the old world. And it is also, it is more abstract and it's got better rule of law. So let me give you some examples, right? You go from the UK to the US to the internet, and you go from, you know, let's say the rights of all Englishmen with, you know, then you go to the all Europeans for a long time. Mm-hmm. That's basically what the US was until 1965. And then with the internet, you go to the whole world. It's more diverse and more inclusive in that sense. Then you go to the law. You go from common law in the UK to a constitution, written law, you know, premises in the US, and you go to cryptography, smart contracts, right? Unambiguous, truly global law executed by code, okay? And just to put a fine point on that, the thing about like the constitution or the legal code is we take this for granted, but judges will interpret it in different ways. The same judge will interpret it in different ways based on whether they've had a coffee or not. There's that apocryphal study that's very famous, mm-hmm. but you know,
end of the, if your judge is getting you right before lunch, you're probably
cranky.
Yeah. Yeah, that's right. I, you know, like there's a lot of social science studies like that, that I'm not sure if they replicate, but it seems plausible, you know? Certainly we know that humans being humans, they're not completely impartial executors of code, right? Mm-hmm. And so you will get a situation where it's arguably like a violation of equal protection where, you know, two people with exactly the same circumstances in Wyoming and Wisconsin are treated by the judicial system differently based on the opinion of the judge, right? So you do not actually have, like, that is actually undesirable for lots of reasons. It's not actually, you know, a truly equal system because there's human discretion and judgment and error and moods and so on that are involved. You really mm-hmm. want it to be more impartial than that. You also want it to be cheaper than that because, you know, like the adjudication of these cases is expensive, et cetera. So if we start flipping it over to smart contracts, you have something where, and of course this starts with commercial things, but it actually extends to more and more things like who is deplatformed when. Right? Who can speak to which users? All of these things. Think about how much of our world is becoming technology.
Could you maybe explain a smart contract? It's very key to Ethereum and to Bitcoin. Yes. So yeah, maybe just for people who aren't initiated, just explain the very concept itself.
Absolutely. Okay. So first, let me get there in like, you know, the short version is a smart contract is a way that computers can execute a contract signed by you and somebody else. And they can handle the dispersion of funds and so on and so forth. So it's as if you trusted a robot as a judge, right? Mm-hmm. Giving a little bit more detail, I can hand a dollar bill to you. Okay, that's offline cash. I can send you a Bitcoin. That's like digital cash or digital gold. And that has a debit for me and a credit for you that's recorded on the Bitcoin blockchain. Ethereum takes that one step further where it's not just I have a debit for me and a credit for you. It could be, here's 10 debits for me. And when it hits an 11th, there's a credit for Sagar, another credit for Marshall. And then you get the inverse square root of, you know, like the credits if you hit this certain level and so on. Mm-hmm. It's like a contract that's just written into code, right? So like interest rates or your mortgage, all of those kinds of things could be put into a literal program. And the difference is it wouldn't just be hosted on one person's server where they could edit the program and change how much money was being owed. It'd be on a blockchain, which is hosted on lots of servers and impossible to falsify. So you would know that, you know, like Sagar, you know, didn't have the terms change on you in some like hard to diligence way, right? Think about mm-hmm. all these adjustable rate mortgages and how opaque that is and when they decide to adjust it. With a smart contract, that would actually be on a blockchain and you could actually see it. And it's like open source. There's a difference between open source versus closed source. You mm-hmm. could actually look at it. You could see it. Computer scientists can look at it. And one of the consequences of this that most people don't understand how important it is yet, I think, with all this trade war stuff that's happening, you know, with the US and China fighting, you know, there is one area where everybody in the world, including Chinese and Americans, is cooperating, and that is with smart contracts. Because Chinese people may not trust the American legal system anymore, and Americans don't trust the Chinese legal system, but both of them trust the blockchain because that is computer code and that is truly neutral. Mathematics, computer science is the universal language of humanity, right? It is more powerful than rule of law, which is executed by American judges in American courts with American biases, or Chinese judges in Chinese courts with Chinese biases, right? So that is very, very powerful. And today we think of smart contracts as dealing with things like what I just mentioned, like interest rates or, you know, loans and things like that. There's a website called defipulse.com, defipulse.com. And the term DeFi basically means decentralized finance. What is happening on Ethereum is it's basically just gone vertical over the last year. It's $30 billion. It's locked in, you know, Ethereum right now. One way of thinking about this is a financial internet. where mm-hmm. programs can send and receive money back and forth. Just like with the internet, they could send and receive information back and forth. So yes. you can have some program take out a loan and then it goes and buys a derivative somewhere. It's all connected together, right? Point being, today, these smart contracts are mainly handling things like, you know, who has what money. Tomorrow, they handle things like who can log in where, who can post where, who can block whom, how long are they blocked for. Lots of these things are basically the building blocks for digital rule of law. Okay. And given that, you know, one one-liner, one of my friends, Daniel Gross, he had, and I love it, is basically 2020 is the year the internet began. You know, because everybody went online and you spend, mm-hmm. you know, if you look at your screen time, you probably spend more time online than you do not looking at a screen for many people, right? Certainly it's true for us, you know, any knowledge worker.
Depressingly right? so.
Yes. Depressingly so, right? So that means that actually the digital world is now primary or the physical world. And so many, 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 many things will be adjudicated with smart contracts. Who's paid what when, who can post when, all that type of stuff, right? And so that is very interesting because it starts being... You can squint at that and see what international rule of law looks like when no one trusts either the US or China to impartially enforce contracts. It can be done digitally. Okay, let me pause there. That's a lot. Go ahead.
Yeah, no, that's a lot. And I think it's great. I think the bow, because we have two last topics we want to hit. The bow I'll tie on this is what relates, everything you're saying relates back to our show's thesis, because in many ways, a defining fact of our age is the fact that trust in institutions, big and small, has collapsed internationally. So yep. you're a person who's very in favor of decentralization. And this is an, not just in favor, but of you're cognizant of the reality that the decentralization effect of technology. So in a world where people don't trust the WHO for very deserving reasons, in a mm-hmm. world where the UN is toothless, technology and these other systems that would actually have some ledger of record that everyone could agree to are going to play a huge role in furthering those dynamics. And it's going to be the clear use case. And that's also why I like how you pointed out that this will start commercially, because that's where you're going to prove these use cases. But let's get to an underlying fact of this conversation, which is this has been a very international conversation. Yep. And this is also in the victory lap category for, even though you've disputed that formulation, obviously. When we first met you, this is for the audience, really. We met you at a, you know, VC firm's office in San Francisco. This was 2019. This is the first time Sagar and
2018, I think.
No, 2019.
Okay.
January. That's right.
I expensed the flights for this, so I very much know when this happened. Yeah. So January 2019, this is the first time we're in SF for business purposes. IRS, in case you're listening, you told us how you were thinking of moving to Austin. And from our perspective, that was crazy. Like,
what?
Yeah. Like, dude, you went to Stanford, you're a professor, you're here, you're Coinbase. Like, why would you possibly leave? You then moved to Austin before that becomes the cool thing to do. But now you've just moved to a mix of Singapore and India. So I think everyone would get a kick out of what's going on there. What's your thought process? Because if 2 years ago you were thinking Austin was the move, it seems to me you're sort of suggesting that 2 years from now, there's something about Asia, because that conversation keeps coming up here. And I think the fact that you're in India and Singapore specifically, and the fact that I appreciated you pointed this out earlier, the conversation about the rise of Asia doesn't have to just be one about authoritarian Chinese power, because Singapore, India, mix of democracy, mix of like a sort of liberal westernized state. There's a lot going on there. So I'd love to just hear your articulation of your thought process there.
Absolutely. So, you know, one thing, I don't know if you've ever seen like these, like, I'm not sure if it's Star Trek or Star Wars, where you have like a starship and it's like moving at a certain speed and then it sees like a threat or whatever. And then it hits like light speed and just like, you know, right. So, you know, I'd always wanted to get to Asia. I'd always thought of Asia as the future and my future. For many reasons, I'd been stuck in, you know, San Francisco or what have you. But it's, you know, like COVID accelerated lots of things. It put 10 years into 1 year, you know, in many ways, right? Like from remote to other things. And I think also it has accelerated the rise of Asia. And Asia, yes, as exactly as you point out, you know, which I've mentioned on my feed, one way of thinking about it, you know, I mean, I'm not sure if this term will catch on, but I use the term DANA, which is Democratic Asia and Australasia, which includes, by the way, Australia and New Zealand. Okay. And when you prefix it with that, okay, that's Asia minus China, you know, so that is South Korea and it's Japan and it's Taiwan and it's, you know, Thailand and it is, you know, Australia, New Zealand, India, Singapore. That's a lot of countries, right? And that's a huge chunk of the world's population that you that is worth and important to look at. I mean, even in 2019, I had this tweet, which I think Morgan Stanley put this up, which basically said, Asia is actually not the future anymore. It's the present. It's more than 51% of world GDP. You know, this is even before Corona, right? And if you go and do a map of COVID-19 and how it's controlled and where the states are that have controlled it, Asia is doing the best, right? Both China and democratic Asia, even India is somewhere in between China and the West, where it has essentially managed to have about 1/10 the death rate of the US on a per capita basis. And you know, maybe that's luck. Maybe it's the fact that they're taking it more seriously. They have, you know, sometime in 2015, one of the most remarkable things that's happened in my life is that India's state capacity exceeded America's. Okay. And most people don't understand this. They don't even know what the heck I'm talking about. But like, you know, somewhere in between healthcare.gov, which was like the website the US government couldn't even put up or whatever, I had to have a bunch of tech people come and bail them out. And the Indian government did something called India Stack, which if you don't know about it, everybody should know about it. There's a good post on Substack that outlines, it's called The Internet Country on India Stack. I can paste the link. I think it's like tigerfeathers.substack.com, something like that. Mm-hmm. And what is India Stack? It is national APIs for payments, identity, data sharing. In addition to this, at the private level, India shipped Reliance Jio, which you know, basically has gotten 400 million people online over the last 4 years. An insane accomplishment, very difficult. That's a physical accomplishment, right? You need to set up these cell phone towers. It has the cheapest mobile data in the world. It's like 100x cheaper than the US, okay? Wow. And that was done in India, where infrastructure is not that easy to come by, you know, the roads and so on. It's all improved dramatically, but it still, you know, wasn't as good. And, you know, like, India also recently during COVID shipped Arogya Sethu, which is a national telemedicine app. And these are things which seem obvious, Bajan, of course.
When you say India, do you mean, did the Indian government shift it? Or are you referring to India as like a concept?
The COVID
app, that's the thing. Yeah, so both, right? So yeah. The Indian government shipped the payments interface, UPI, the identity interface, Aadhaar, there's a new data thing they've got called DEPA, and Arogya Sethu, National Telemedicine App. The private sector, in collaboration in some ways with the government, Reliance Jio, got 400 million people, 400 million Indians online. And separately, India has become now number three in the world for tech unicorns after the US and China. It's massively underestimated. People just like, India is just going to take the world by storm in the 2020s. I've been tracking it for some time and whatever. That's my job, is being a seed investor or whatever, you know, seeing this stuff. It's not even that. India is not seed, of course, anymore in this context. It's like Series B or Series C, you know, to use that terminology. But it is still underpriced and underappreciated in a big way. Enormous amount of talent there that's now online. Okay. And so the way I kind of think about it is, you know, so first, Asia is not really even the future anymore. It's a present. Second, you have the best, I think, upside and potential here. Third, you know, like the reason, you know, I moved from SF to Austin, then Austin out here, is because, you know, I could see SF getting worse. And I knew it was going to get worse. And I knew that Austin had some good properties. Then Austin actually imported a bunch of bad stuff from SF. and then, you know, you had like things like Alex Jones going in the street and telling everybody to shake hands or some crazy stuff. You know, you have basically both, like, the craziest aspects of both left and right came to Austin in some ways, right? Where you had the basically San Francisco's homeless policy got imported, and you had crazy people going and shaking hands in the streets with no masks, you know? So That's actually the worst, right? You know, it kind of convinced me. I mean, one of the things about Asia right now, it's funny because 50 years ago, it was totally reversed, right? The West, relatively speaking, had a sober head on its shoulders, and India was socialist, it was under emergency, China was communist, like there was starvation, famine, cultural revolution, you know, like Japan was okay, right? But, you know, a lot of the rest was either poor or just becoming wealthier. You know, Singapore actually, you know, in 1965 was a third world country, you know, if you go and read Lee Kuan Yew's book From Third World to First. But now everything is flipped. You know, like Asia is absolutely rising and the West is declining. And, you know, this is something which is, I think, super obvious if you look at GDP share, for example. You know, you pulled the World Bank stuff. You're just seeing like US and Europe's share of GDP declining. How could they not? Because you have a billion Indians and a billion Chinese and a ton of other people who are smart, who are just held back by terrible systems, right? They're held back by socialism, held back by communism. Now they're competing on the world stage. But one of the consequences of this is that the West, especially the US, is souring on free speech and free markets because, you know, I tweeted this, but basically, I think a deep point, the East Coast establishment no longer wins a game of truly free speech and free markets. You know, if anybody can publish anything on social media, the mainstream media can't control the narrative. And so that's where they're pushing for all the censorship. They've got that op-ed in the NYT, free speech is killing us, you know, which is canonical. Mm-hmm. There's got a bunch more like that. And then, you know, with free markets, this Wall Street Bets thing made it very clear, right? Not, it's just something where it was only educational or you know, it was of educational value because everybody could see it. But Wall Street no longer wins a game of truly free markets because if, you know, these proletarians are actually able to trade, then, you know, a thumb is put on the scale. And you can argue, I think the Robinhood thing was not, if everybody followed that, Robinhood shutting off buy capability was actually due to the antiquated backend system. You can argue that's part of Wall Street regulatory capture. But Discord going and shutting down the groups and, you know, yeah, that's just wrong, you know, on the premise of hate speech or whatever. And I mean, that's just like, look, if you have 5 million people, is someone going to make some shitty comment? Absolutely. They're going to make it. It's like literally a country level thing, you know, and you just cannot control thoughts at that scale. And nor should you really, you can't, you know, like the level of control needed to impose that is bad. Of course, people should keep it in their pants, but point being that Wall Street doesn't win a game of truly free markets either, right? So because of that, a lot of these things that people thought of as eternal principles, you know, if you can't win, break the game, right? So the East Coast establishment is turning away from the values that it stood for. Just like earlier, we were talking about how, you know, the CEO that set up the international system, the US is leaving that international system because it no longer serves its interests. And when I say it, I actually mean the East Coast establishment's interests, because I think actually, certainly the West Coast can win in a game, or at least a good chunk of the West Coast, the pro-privacy, pro-surveillance, pro-privacy, pro-encryption, anti-surveillance, you know, folks can win in a game of free speech and free markets. There's still a Western, you know, whether you want to call it elite or group or managerial group or something that can win in that game, but not the East Coast establishment. And I think that the people at large will also win in that game, just like, you know, China thought that they couldn't win in a game of free markets. That's why they went communist, but of course they can, you know, and that's why they adopted it. India thought wait, for a Balaji, long time. Go ahead. Yeah.
This is we've been crescendoing towards, this is just an interesting point though. I want to know your definition of free markets though, because something Sagar and I are obsessed with is the way ideologies and labels are really changing, because at various points during this podcast, you've praised like increasing state capacity. You've praised the direction of India's government. And there are a lot of people who are adjacent to you ideologically and adjacent to you on Twitter who don't focus on state capacity, who would say, yeah, China's now competing in the free market, but the China is also very, once again, direct in its imposition of national priorities, focus areas, state-directed investment, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So can you just articulate for us what your definition of free markets would be? Because here's a better way of articulating this. There are a lot of people who think free markets means the state has no role in what's basically going on. It's the very libertarian case. So it'd just be good to get your clarification there.
Right. So I will see if I can come up with an extremely compact description, but I think, you know, like the maximum freedom consistent with some degree of public order. Mm-hmm. Okay. So that's, you know, Lee Kuan Yew is close to that. Now, of course, you might say, oh, Singapore, you know, they have top-down control and some things. They do, but the fundamental legitimacy there is from migration, which is to say more people want to get in than want to get out, and high-quality people want to get in versus get out, right? And I think that that's where it's going to come down to. Here's why. I think of ideologies of any kind as like points on a slider, you know? Should the government do everything or should it do nothing? You know, should we have like, you know, just in the context of like a company, should everybody work remote or should they work in person? You know, should we use Google Docs or should we use Office 365? Lots of these kinds of things are basically things on a set of sliders. And your answer, there's actually multiple solutions. You know, you could have a country, for example, where like the Netherlands, where drugs is legalized, or you could have one that just bans drugs and there's a death penalty for drug smugglers. And those are both functional countries, like the Netherlands and Singapore are both functional countries. They attract immigrants and so on. In the same way that you could have multiple solutions for company cultures, you know, Apple's culture, Google's culture, Facebook's, Amazon's are radically different. But internally, they each work, right? So there's multiple solutions culturally. Once you kind of come to that, you know, realization that, you know, a lot of these ideological things, they sort of interlock. And the way to judge them is based on migration as opposed to election. You know, basically, if you can only have one of the two, you'd prefer to be able to travel at low cost between jurisdictions and have 1,000 of them, because then you actually have individual choice over the legal system. There's at least 1,000 different jurisdictions to go between. This is actually part of, by the way, the UN Human Rights Declaration in 1948, I believe, which is that freedom of migration is like a fundamental human right, right? That's going to become a bigger and bigger thing, by the way, with lockdown taking that away to some extent. It's going to become a bigger thing. It's all the exit stuff is also kind of maybe ahead of the game. Okay. But coming back up a stack, when you say, you know, free markets or free speech, of course, it's like an extremal point on a slider. You can always caricature, right? Do you know free speech? Oh, you want people to be able to just paste in porn into your email or whatever? You know, like you can of course caricature it that way, right? And you know what I think it is it's going to come down to we don't have, like, on the internet, there's 3 billion people, and they don't agree on community norms anymore. Like the legacy nation state norms just, you know, aren't shared. You know, new norms have formed. And so you're just going to get multiple solutions. Just like companies, you're going to get these internet communities that are going to form into clusters. And they are going to define what limits on markets, limits on speech, permissions on speech, or whatever are there. Mm-hmm. With that said, I think that the maximum freedom consistent with order is the long-term strategy. Because, you know, there's like actually the Chinese of all people, you know, they have a saying, which is the backwards will be beaten. Right. This is actually Scholar Stage has a good post on this. This guy, exactly. Right. Yeah. That's right. So he has a good, you know, thing on this. The backwards will be beaten. What that does, by the way, is it combines the trade-off between rationalism and nationalism. Right. Nationalism is thump chest. We're the best. Our country's the best. You know, yay America, yay China, whatever. Right. You know, and you kind of actually need that. I always underestimated nationalism until I got into crypto, where I saw the effect of crypto tribalism and how it actually had monetary consequences. Like, okay, well, you know, there's something to mindless chest thumping. It actually keeps people together. You know,
HODL is crypto nationalism.
Literal crypto Bitcoin maximalism.
Exactly. And in fact, actually, you know, I'm using nationalism in the most general sense, where some people are nationalistic about their countries, others about their cities, others about their companies, and still others about their cryptocurrencies, right? And so it's like, where is their group identity, you know? And just as a sidebar, by the way, this is a very useful thing. Whenever you see people get really mad when other people criticize, let's say, San Francisco or, you know, like New York, often it's because their principal point, they identify themselves as a San Franciscan or a New Yorker. And the company they work at, they're like, yeah, whatever, I'm working at, you know, like Morgan today, I'll work at Citibank tomorrow, but what I care about is Central Park. I care about New York. I care about the bagels. F you, you're saying New York isn't going to come back. Well, we're in New York and we're strong. And so, right? So, right? And, you know, like the thing is, once you put yourself in the frame, okay, that's a principal identity component. They are nationalistic New Yorkers, right?
Can I just pause you there? Because we're on limited time and I want to make sure I hit this point with you, because this is actually a key point to what we want to, this is the last thing, just 5, 6, 10 minutes or so, which is on Clubhouse and Twitter. Because what are the things that you're pointing to is that there's actually a lot of self-identification within media where they're like, when we're mainstream media, like we're the only ones that are legitimate, speaking to your nationalist kind of tribal element there. And with technology, and the rise of, and we talked about this earlier in the episode, you know, with Clubhouse and Substack and more, now we see the emergence of platforms where they don't necessarily rule. So there's an interesting dynamic actually, though, here, where you have a tech platform, which is Twitter, which is launching a competing app to Clubhouse, which is probably the most, like, the single biggest competitor in social media that we've seen in the last 10 years. Now, how do you expect that to play out? Because the personalities that exist on Twitter and dominate the platform are in many ways exactly the people who are the powerhouses of the New York Times and more. Do you think who will win within that battle of like Clubhouse versus Twitter and the Twitter spaces, which is where that is coming?
Okay. So I think there's actually like 3 different players there, right? There's kind of, you know, legacy, it's funny to put it this way, legacy tech companies or establishment tech companies like Twitter, for example. There's the new tech companies like Clubhouse, it's actually Substack. And then there's legacy media, right? And I think, you know, the most important thing is that, you know, Google, Facebook, Twitter, et cetera, they never thought of legacy media as their competition, right? Any disruption that happened, happened by accident because they just, you know, they went for advertiser revenue and they happened to be, their back end, the sales teams were competing for the same clients, right? So you're calling on the same guy at Mercedes or whatever that also is thinking about placing a front page ad in the NYT, right? So of course, Craigslist did this as well with classifieds earlier on, and some would argue it's even more important, but both, right? None of them set out to disrupt media or compete with media. Now, however, the New York Times has set out to compete with tech companies. If you saw that article in Information, Meredith Levine, the new NYT CEO, she's like, we're going to compete with Spotify. We're going to compete with Netflix. This is related to Ben Smith's thing about how, you know, the New York Times have become a collection of juicy narratives, right? In extremists, that's Caliphate, where the narrative seems to be completely made up, right? As, you know, or Miles Taylor, or maybe 1619, lots of these other things. Walter Duranty, Herbert Matthews, Jason Blair.
You got
Jason
your
Blair.
List. The list is too long. The list is too long.
Yeah.
Right. So quite a lot of juicy narratives out there, right? And they're great movies. I'm not sure if they're great facts. But the media companies are now trying to compete with tech companies. They're very explicit about it. They're saying number two department are engineers, and you know they talk about conversions. And part of it is just because they've reported on tech for so aggressively over the last 7 years, and they dislike tech and they envy tech in many ways, you know, because tech has all these users and it has all these money and wait a second, we're supposed to be super influential and, you know, blah, blah, blah. That's a huge part of it, right? This kind of wounded amour proper of like the, you know, old money versus new money. Because those newspaper owners are absolutely old money. They inherited their newspapers, whereas, you know, Zuckerberg didn't inherit his company, he founded it, right? So there's that being that dynamic. What hasn't, and then you've got the media companies, as I mentioned, now getting into tech. What I don't think they expected, but it's the most obvious thing in the world, is tech is also going to get into media. Right. And now is explicitly thinking of media companies as competitors. And it's essentially something where for 7 years, we didn't bring the other hand out from behind the back. There's enormous reserve capacity here if we actually set out to do something. Right. When tech set out to go and disrupt Blockbuster, it didn't reform Blockbuster, built Netflix, right? Disrupt BlackBerry, that's the iPhone, you know, disrupt Barnes and Noble's, that's Amazon. So the re-envisioning of media as a first party thing done by tech is happening, right? Substack and Clubhouse are just kind of two examples of it, but there's things in common, right? First, peer to peer, right? So it's much more equal. They don't have privileged nodes. You just come there and it's an equal competition. That's what I mean by like free speech and free markets consistent with order, you know?
Yes.
Yeah, of course, if you're posting porn or spam, yeah, they will ban you, right? But, you know, Substack has taken, I think, an admirably principled stance. Number two is, because these media corporations are their competitors, like literally they are, Substack is literally recruiting writers. Krugman just went and, you know, put his thing on Substack, right? A bunch of others have. Like that is a zero-sum thing in some ways with the NYT. Where is the content going to go at NYT or is it going to go to their own Substack? Now, of course, this actually makes more money for those journalists than, and more, you know, like they've got their own newsletter subscribers. They've built their own brands, right? It is aligned with their interests, but it's not aligned with the interests of the New York Times company, right? The parent entity. Similarly with Clubhouse, like the reason that these, in my view, these tech journalists are freaking out is, you know, Sriram and Arthi, who, you know, Sriram's a new partner at Anderson. Arthi is a, you know, well-known engineer and founder, his wife. And, you know, they had Elon and Zuck on their new Clubhouse show, right? Those are gets for any, you know, that'd be like a career-making get for any tech journalist, right?
Yes.
What is happening now is the status flippening. Right. So in crypto, there's this concept of the flippening when, you know, like it came back a while ago, which is when does Bitcoin flip the dollar or when does Bitcoin, you know, Ethereum flip Bitcoin and so on. Right. People talk about this. Right. So the status flippening is basically that a lot of folks in tech and actually a lot of folks in Hollywood as well, that's less well reported, but it's also, I think, very important. A lot of folks in tech, a lot of folks in Hollywood have just been taking beatings from media corporations for the past 7 or 8 years. And, you know, like there is no give and take. There's no win in talking to a journalist from a legacy media corporation who's a direct competitor, B, not just an economic competitor, but out to get you personally, right? You've got, you know, actually Nellie Bowles wrote about this just now. She had a thing on her Substack where she admitted that she called a bunch of the articles she put out kills, right? You know, other journalists have, you know, Hamilton Nolan a few weeks ago, months ago in the Washington Post admitted that journalism is about, or rather he's the, not in the Washington Post, he is the CJR I think, employed or funded or platformed person mm-hmm. who's the Washington Post external public editor. He wrote something like, journalism about the raw exercise of power, right? Last year, you know, when The Verge ran this article on Steph Curry, their editor-in-chief posted something like, oh, you know, our reporter gets results when they were fired, right? So essentially their job is to make you lose your job, right? And so it's not just economic competition. It's an extremely hostile, personal kind of thing where journalists literally are paid to get you fired, right? And so what is now happening is, you know, Elon or Zuck or every other CEO or executive that isn't completely in the tank is like, yeah, it is not in my fiduciary duty. It's not in my employees' interests. It's not in our products' interests or our customers' interests, our users' interests, our investors' interests, or my interest to go and give free content to these corporations that are A, our competitors, B, who hate us, C, are envious, and D, who are just like, you know, ideologically disaligned in many different ways, you know, now pushing for censorship, pushing for, you know, like eavesdropping on Signal, all of this type of stuff. They're just increasingly ideologically disaligned. So why go and give them, you know, anything? Just build our own. That's what we do. That's literally our entire thing. Go ahead.
So we have to wrap with this question. Yeah. So I'm sort of cheating when I ask you this, but mm-hmm. this is my legacy media side. Then why did the CEO of Robinhood go and speak of Ross Sorkin? On CNBC because the thing is, and I think that the part where I 100% disagree with tech journalists is that everything you're describing with Substack and Clubhouse, they're inevitable. There's nothing that could be done here. From my perspective, I have no idea why a tech CEO would go do a softball interview at a conference where they have to travel, do all those big things when they could do a really good, really fun Clubhouse thing. I don't know why you would go announce news on a New York Times Kara Swisher interview. 100% agree with that. But at the same time, there's a, like, look at the height of Robinhood, the Robinhood fiasco. If Robinhood had tried to go direct, actually, they did try to go direct for a while, it didn't work because no one trusted them. So there still is a space for media companies. And look, I think the New York Times has largely seeded this, especially because of the behavior of certain New York Times reporters on Twitter. But that being said, CNBC still has the credibility to be the place where these debates are adjudicated in ways that Clubhouse wouldn't be. So I think the Good Time show that you're referring to on Clubhouse is great, but that is not like hard-hitting journalism. And it's not the place where anyone would go to actually hear the Clubhouse debate get adjudicated as literally billions of dollars are on the line. So how do you think about this? How do you just think about the mix? Because I think that it's not that these things are going to replace one another. So the New York Times can't cancel Clubhouse, but Clubhouse isn't going to replace the New York Times, because what they're going to do is unbundle the things the New York Times used to do and fulfill those functions better. So I would much rather watch Elon Musk have an interesting conversation on Clubhouse than watching a semi-hostile, semi-like, you know, soapboxy interview with the New York Times. But I would also not trust a VC to do a hard-hitting interview with Robinhood. So how do you just think about how that, you know, mixes out between each other?
Totally. Okay. So three or four points there, right? So yeah. First is, media corporations do PR for media corporations and journalists do PR for journalists. Some obvious examples, Democracy Dies in Darkness, equating your newspaper as democracy, right?
Right.
Now, neither the Times nor the Washington Post, to my knowledge, were written into the US Constitution or are part of the definition of democracy in Wikipedia, but through enough marketing. And when I say marketing, I literally mean marketing, like advertisements designed by for-profit corporations to equate themselves, right, with the truth, right? You talk mm-hmm. about like the corporate control. That's literally the corporate control of, you know, the government, right? If you're saying that a media corporation is actually the definition of democracy, right? Number one. Number two is, they don't hold themselves accountable. I'll give several examples, right? You know, during Bloomberg's campaign, there was this admission that Bloomberg reports on but does not investigate CNBC and Reuters, okay? Because they're their competitors for financial journalism. Why? That's a great construction of a sentence. Reports on but does not investigate. Reports on meaning if there's some scandal that they cannot ignore, they will put up a pro forma wire story on it to say that, yeah, we printed it, it was under our brand. But mm-hmm. does not investigate means they never go for the throat, right? They don't go for them like they went for Uber. They don't go for them like, you know, they've gone and attacked so many tech people, because there's a professional courtesy where there's a degree of mutual disarmament. This is also similar to, you know, the leak that I believe whether CBS that went after ABC or vice versa, there was a leaker who leaked, I think, Amy Rohrbach, who was talking about the Epstein case. And that leaker was, or was someone who was accused of being the leaker was at another company. Yeah, and it was either fired. ABC got, she was fired, right?
She was fired by CBS, right?
She was fired by CBS. So that's a great example of collusive behavior between media corporations where one guy at ABC can get someone fired at CBS for leaking, right? This would be as if, you know, like a former employee of Facebook left and talked to the NYT or whatever, and then Google got called up Facebook to get them fired, right? That we actually compete with each other in tech. You know, either, even the hint of collusive behavior several years ago was like this antitrust case where basically I think Jobs and it wasn't antitrust, but it was an anti-competitive case. Jobs and Eric Schmidt had agreed not to recruit each other's engineers. Yeah. And there's a huge fine for that, right? So tech companies actually do go for the throat in the sense of trying to disrupt each other, right? They really do try. Media companies don't. A third example was, I think, NBC killing Ronan Farrow's story, right? But one of the most egregious examples has been around the early coronavirus coverage, you know, whether it was don't worry about, you know, the coronavirus, worry about the flu, which BuzzFeed put out there, whether it was, you know, beware the pandemic panic in the NYT, whether it was no handshakes, please, the Recode article. The fact remains that none of their colleagues who bleated endlessly about Theranos held them accountable. Right. There was no investigative journalism into this. There was no personal attacks. There were no like long, you know, profiles of the CEOs of, you know, BuzzFeed or Recode or, you know, NYT for that matter, because they're all either colluding with each other or scared of each other. So the most important thing I can say is the softball interviews and the softball advertising is media corporations on themselves, right? They define themselves as equating with democracy. Okay. So once you have competition into the space that does not play by those rules, right? Mm-hmm. That simply does not concede. And frankly, also, and this is important, tech is, I don't know if you saw this website, literally tech journalism is less diverse than tech.com. It's by a Nigerian guy.
I saw that.
It's a great website, which shows that tech is actually 30 points more diverse than media and is the same on gender. Okay. Now that's something that you hadn't heard for the last 7 years, right? And so, you know, it's not simply something that media corporations have dropped the ball on COVID. It's not simply something that they collude with each other. It's not just that they market themselves as the truth. It's not just that they try to get people fired for profit. It's not just that they are a collection of juicy narratives. It is also that they're 30 points less diverse. And so if you actually want to diversify media, the media corporations aren't going to do it themselves. Tech is going to have to do that, right? You know, there's like more than a billion Indians. How many, you know, like of those folks are on the NYT op-ed page? I actually don't think there are any, right? And so I may be wrong, but that's my recollection. And so, you know, it's not actually representative of the world. And tech to a much greater extent is, and crypto even more so, you know, it's a fully global kind of thing. So that's like one huge aspect, which is media corporations don't hold themselves accountable. They define themselves as the truth. They need an external party to hold them accountable. Second aspect is I agree.
Wait, one last point.
Here's what we'll do.
Yeah.
Ah, shoot.
Let me just get it out here.
Yeah, get it.
I do believe also in absolute truth. So I do think that these tech companies will come up and compete. I don't think that it should just be purely corporations all doing PR for themselves. Okay. Mm-hmm. I do believe in absolute truth. I've got a post on the Ledger of Record where decentralized cryptographic truth through mathematics and cryptography allows us to establish unambiguous facts. And that's what everybody refers to, not some corporation, neither a tech nor a media corporation, but a decentralized cryptographic platform, which relates to our earlier stuff.
Apology. Thank you so much for coming. We're going to have to do this again sometime soon.
Yes.
Thank you so much. And congratulations on the move and all the crazy things that we're going to see in the next few years.
Thanks, Balaji.
Thank you. Cool.
Thanks for listening to the episode. We really appreciate it. Make sure you guys subscribe to therealignment.substack.com in order to get our weekly newsletter and ask us questions. Make sure you take a look at our bookshop. Make sure you take a look at The Realignment on Twitter, YouTube, everywhere that you guys get your podcasts, and leave us a 5-star review. And with that, thank you to the Lincoln Network for sponsoring this podcast. We really appreciate it.
We'll see you on Thursday.